Good evening. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. Ahead tonight, Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth gives us details regarding last night's protests in Fayetteville as another city in northwest Arkansas sees people taking note of the death of George Floyd while in police custody. Tomorrow on Here and Now on KUAF, the latest news regarding coronavirus and protests from around the country. And we'll hear from author Claudia Rankin about the nationwide protests and how understanding whiteness could be key to understanding race in America. That's on tomorrow's Here and Now, beginning at 1, right after tomorrow afternoon's edition of Ozarks at Large. And after our show tonight, stay with 91.3 for the latest hour of the national conversation from All Things Considered at NPR. The latest news regarding the virus. That begins at 8 tonight. Arkansas's total of cumulative cases of COVID-19 increased by 249 yesterday, and there were 6 deaths yesterday from the virus. The state has now recorded 142 deaths and a cumulative total of 8,067 cases. Dr. Nate Smith, the state's Secretary of Health, says there are more than 2,200 active cases in Arkansas. He also says the state's most populated counties are among those with the most new cases of the virus.
Where they're coming from is similar to what we've seen in the last, in the previous few days. We had 28 from Washington County, 20 from Benton County, 23 from Sevier County. Now, something that's new is we had 33 from Pulaski County, and these were not associated with a nursing home. So we're going to have to watch our numbers here in Pulaski County and be very careful not to let down on those practices of physical distancing, wearing masks, et cetera.
Much of today's briefing centered on long-term care facilities and nursing homes and the virus. This month, the state is attempting to test every patient and staff member at nursing homes throughout the state. Rachel Bunch, the executive director of the Arkansas Healthcare Association, says the plan to conduct the tests at each long-term facility is ambitious.
The logistics of this process are massive, and we've never done anything quite like this before, but I have great confidence in both my members and our partners that are working with this, and I know that we will meet the governor's expectations. Having this information about where positive cases are will help us make decisions and implications for the future.
While the testing takes place at long-term facilities, Dr. Smith says younger people are the fastest rising percentage of those testing positive for COVID-19.
We're seeing the fastest growth in number of cases in those basically in the 25 and under age group. So we are seeing both community spread, and then we're seeing involvement in some of the poultry-related industries as well. So we're attacking this, you know, both in terms of working with those workplaces to make them as safe as possible, but also doing those contact tracing in the community.
The governor's press briefings are archived at his YouTube channel, and you can keep up to date with how COVID-19 is affecting the region and state at the COVID-19 update page at KUAF.com. We also have information about the virus during our morning newscast each Monday through Friday at 5:30 and 7:30 with Antoinette Grajeda. And you can learn more about how nonprofit agencies and organizations are dealing with the pandemic during the Community Spotlight with Pete Hartman at 6:30 and 8:30 each Monday through Friday morning. This is Ozarks at Large. During Governor Asa Hutchinson's daily COVID-19 briefings, officials present several pieces of data that track the pandemic's progression in the state. Springdale resident Misty Orpin has been analyzing the Department of Health's data and sharing it on a new Twitter account called Arkansas COVID. She says she started tracking the material in late March and launched her Twitter account in early April. Today, her research also includes the website ArkansasCOVID.com, which includes raw data, county snapshots, and a podcast. Last week, she spoke via Zoom with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about her project. She explained she started the Twitter account because she has had lots of questions about how COVID-19 was spreading in Arkansas, particularly in her community.
And the information that I was able to find from the state database at that time was just woefully incomplete. I wasn't able to answer any of those questions. You know, you could see like cumulative numbers, but you couldn't really see percent change from day to day. At that time, they weren't tracking things by county either. So you couldn't go online and see, okay, how many of those cases were in Washington County versus how many of those new cases were in Benton County or Pulaski County. So it was really hard to make decisions about like my family's safety, or, you know, did I feel comfortable going out to the grocery store, or do I need to do grocery pickup or things like that. I wasn't able to have the data to make decisions that I felt good about with the information that was being provided. And I just didn't see anyone tracking that at the level that satisfied me. So I just started tracking it myself so that I could personally know. And it evolved into, well, I'll just post some of these statistics on Twitter. And it grew quickly from there. Actually, I started the website because my dad's not on Twitter and he lives in Polk County. And he was always asking me for information. So I started the website just so my dad would know what was going on because he refuses to get on Twitter.
Do you have a background in statistics and data?
No, I'm not a data scientist. My background is actually in journalism. I was a journalist for several years. And then I worked in economic development. I did, you know, the Greenway development around Northwest Arkansas. I worked in downtown redevelopment in Springdale. And then I went to work at the U of A, and I did take on several data projects at the U of A. They were a lot different than this. So I'm not totally new to, you know, statistics and data management, but this is certainly a larger project than I've undertaken before, especially by myself.
Have you been surprised at how it's grown?
Yeah, what has surprised me the most is not really how many people are interested in the data, because I think, again, people are literally, they crave data because we're using that to make decisions. Like, a lot of people don't know what to do. And the state database, while it has improved, the state still isn't tracking things in a very user-friendly way. That information is not being presented as it's not as easily accessible as it is in some states. And I don't think it's as easily accessible as most people want, which is one of the reasons that I'm so present on Twitter, is because I like actually want to answer people's questions. You know, people have, like, I want people to consider me their COVID secretary or their COVID Siri, right? Where you can just ask Siri a question and she'll spout it back. If it's a data related question to COVID, I try to just kind of be your little robot assistant there. So I think it's grown because of that, because there really hasn't been anywhere that people felt that they could reach out to like ask personal questions about what's happening in my county. But then what surprised me the most is how cordial people have been on Twitter. Like, you actually think of Twitter as this kind of this morass of people picking on each other and fighting. And especially on something that's been as politicized as the spread of COVID-19. But I find that people on the platform have been very kind to one another. Now, I will say they may not always been as kind to the public officials that are making decisions, but they have been really good to one another, and there hasn't been a whole lot of misinformation. That's another reason I think it's important, because I think when no one's giving accurate information that's easy for people to understand and access, then people create their own information that may not be accurate. So if there's nothing there to fill that void, then bad information is going to fill that void. So I think that's important. But yeah, I feel like people have been really kind, and they've also not spread a lot of false information on there. And that's been surprising.
Have you developed a relationship with the Department of Health?
Yeah, actually, I have a contact there that I try to limit myself to one email a day to her. That email may contain 15 questions, but she is fantastic and she gets back with me quickly. Actually, we crowdfunded lunch for the Emergency Operations Center at the Arkansas Department of Health, because just in interacting with her, I know she's responding to emails at 7 o'clock at night, right? And she doesn't really have to do that. They're all working around the clock. And so I'm very appreciative of what they're doing and the level of transparency that they're giving to people like myself who have these questions. I feel like Dr. Smith, Nate Smith, the Secretary of Health, has kind of set this tone of transparency that is really being carried through. I do, as I said earlier, some of the information isn't presented in a way that I wish that it were. I think that has more to do with just limited information system or limited training on some of maybe the products that are available that other states may have that Arkansas doesn't use.
Do you have a specific example of something that you would like to see it done a certain way that it's not being presented a certain way?
Oh my gosh, yes. Every chart that I post on my website, I wish the state would post on its website so I could stop. I would love to be irrelevant. I would love for what Arkansas COVID is doing to be just regurgitating something else that someone has already done, because I don't really want to be spending all this time tracking this data. I want someone else to do that. I want the state to do that. You know, I want a journalist to do that. Like, I'm doing it because of absence, and because now I would feel really bad if I stopped doing it, because I feel like some people are relying on it. But yeah, I wish that the state would track things better in a visual way that is responsive to the needs that have clearly been elucidated by people in Arkansas. Another thing is I really wish that they would present the percent of tests that are returning positive each day in a manner that is understandable, because it doesn't add up. Like, the numbers that they give each day, they don't work. And I know why they don't work. But to make them work, you have to reverse engineer them, which most people aren't going to do. So simple things like that I think could be done differently.
Have you sent your suggestions to anybody as a
department? Oh yeah. Yes. I'm a pesterer. I pester. I have sent my suggestions, and there are some things that have improved. There have been improvements. Not all of them, clearly, because I'm still here.
When data is presented, there's often an argument about what is being presented. You know, is this the most accurate, or is this the information? Even if it is accurate, is this the information that we should be paying attention to in this case to make certain decisions? Is there one thing that you might say is the biggest misconception about data, or the biggest problem with people looking at a chart?
So, what you said about the way things are presented, that's actually something that I focus a lot on, is every day looking at the charts that are presented by the state in the daily press conferences. And if those seem to be inaccurate or misleading, I fact check the heck out of those to make sure that, like, people aren't being misled. And I think that's one of the things that has gained a lot of trust, maybe, in credibility on that platform, is just helping people understand what's relevant and what's not relevant. I think the state has done a pretty good job overall with, like, how accurately they've been presenting things. There's been a couple of misses in there, but most of it's been pretty accurate. I think maybe there is a problem in leaders wanting to make people feel better. So they may present the data in such a way that they don't want people to worry. They want them to feel better. They want people to think that they're doing their job well, which means they want to show that, you know, numbers are going down or we're on a decline. It's fine to go out and spend money. And it's fine to present the truth. I wish more people understood that what's more disturbing than hearing bad news is hearing news that, you know, is inherently not true from the leadership, and then you're not able to make accurate decisions at all. And again, I don't think Arkansas is doing a lot of that, but I think that there have been some times where, you know, I know something's being said, and I think it's just purely to make people feel better. It doesn't really jive with what's happening on the ground.
So what comes next? Just continue as you are?
Well, actually, no, I'm hopeful that I get some help, because again, it takes, like, we're talking like hours and hours and hours a day. It's a huge time commitment. And I've had some really awesome people reach out and want to help, some at the U of A, so the journalism department at the University of Arkansas. Hopefully I'll be able to get some help from their talented students, as well as there's just this awesome person in Little Rock who's a data queen down there. And she has been trying to help me develop a workflow that's a little bit smoother than what I'm doing right now.
What else should we know?
I think the account, because it's it fact checks everything, right? It's not, it doesn't take things at face value. It's very trust but verify. That's the mode that it's always in. I think sometimes it's seen as being a criticism of the state and how the state has handled things. When actually I think Dr. Smith has done a phenomenal job at the Arkansas Department of Health and leading this effort. And I'm sad to see him go. And I hope that whatever comes next is as good, is as helpful as he's, you know, the job that he's done, especially with the level of transparency that he's given to the media on this. That's pretty huge because you see a lot of states are just, they're not doing that. And so Arkansas has been very fortunate to have someone at the helm that is doing that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the data and your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Springdale resident Misty Orpin, creator of the Arkansas COVID Twitter account. She spoke via Zoom with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda last week. More information available at arkansascovid.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. I have a mask on because I'm inside the Karen Taha News Studio with Daniel Carruth. Daniel, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Kyle?
Very good. I would estimate we're 6 feet apart, and I just want to point that out. We are social distancing, and I've got a mask on. But we're talking to you because last night you went to the protest that was on the Fayetteville Square, a protest to bring more attention to the deaths of Black Americans in police custody.
Yes, it was a protest for justice for George Floyd in the wake of protests across the country. It was organized mostly by, it looks like, University of Arkansas students. One guy, Alex Victorino, created the Facebook page that this event was around.
So you were there for about 7 hours.
I was there from 5 o'clock until midnight. Yes.
Give me a sense of what it was like.
So there were about 4,000 people, upwards of several thousand there last night. I was close to the middle of the square where there were speakers starting around 6:30, 7 o'clock. So I couldn't really tell until I went out into the crowd, and it was packed. People coming and going from about, I would say, 6:30 until probably 9 o'clock, people were coming and going.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what it sounded like. That was last night on the Fayetteville Square. You were able to talk to some people, including one of the featured speakers.
Yes, I talked to DeAndre Jones. He is on the City of Fayetteville's African American Advisory Council. He's the chairman, I believe. I spoke to him a little bit. He was one of the main speakers. Before he went on, I spoke to him for a second, and here's what he had to say.
Black people are seeking access to a meaningful and focused life. But for 400 years, that hasn't been the case. And because of systemic racism, we've been locked out. We've been prevented from achieving a meaningful and focused life. And unfortunately, in many cases, we are killed. And tonight in Fayetteville, we are standing up and speaking out against that.
DeAndre Jones, who would later, after that, address the entirety of the protests last night. So we had seen just 24 hours previously in Bentonville a protest that turned into a little bit more of a chaotic situation. What was the feel with law enforcement at last night in Fayetteville?
So I spoke with Sergeant Anthony Murphy about what the protocol was for police officers. There were police there about 60 police officers from different cities in the county, including the Fayetteville Police Department. They were in their regular uniform with fluorescent vests on. And he said that was a decision that the chief made, not to wear riot gear and to stand with the protesters to work with the organizers to make this a peaceful protest in light of what happened in Bentonville on Monday night. He said that the coordination that they used for this event was similar to something that they used during Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue.
I see. And then you also talked to the deputy chief, Jamie Fields, who, what did Jamie Fields have to say about how protesters and law enforcement worked
together, I guess, last night?
Yeah, she said that this is something that the Fayetteville Police Department does on a regular basis, so she wasn't surprised that there was a protest here. They've dealt with that before. She said they hadn't dealt with anything this large before, but she said it was important for the police department to work with protesters on the demonstration. And this is a little bit more of what she had to say.
At Fayetteville, we are very much familiar with our citizens coming out and supporting different causes or protesting different causes. We've always had a great relationship with our community in that manner, and we support their peaceful protest. And so we're not surprised by this at all. The country is grieving right now, and emotions are high. And the Fayetteville Police Department, men and women of the Fayetteville Police Department, we are very accustomed to being in our community. And so we stay with our community. So,
Fayetteville Police Deputy Chief Jamie Field speaking with Daniel Kruth last night on the Fayetteville Square. It went till at least midnight. One of the things with these protests that we've noticed is that there might be a start time, but there isn't necessarily a unified, agreed-upon end time.
Right. So the event, according to the Facebook group, it was supposed to last from about 6:30 to 9 p.m. And around 9 o'clock, I think the organizer, Alex Victorino, was on a megaphone telling people it's 9 o'clock, it's time to go. And a lot of people did leave at that time, but around then, people sort of, they clustered in different parts along the square. And at one point, some fireworks went off. There were a few scuffles, just like confusion, but no one was hurt or injured. And it seemed to calm down after a few seconds and people realized what was happening.
I want to ask you something. So let's play, you have sound, yes, of the firecrackers. I want to play just a little bit of that here.
Yeah.
Did you and other people that were still in the square, did you know those were firecrackers? Because there's potential there for panic.
Right. And initially there was some people rushed back past me. There were not enough people there for anyone to really get hurt or trampled that I saw. And I couldn't tell until I saw a firecracker go into the air what it was. And then through, because I was near the Bank of Fayetteville, you could see through the glass and there was just a firework display almost going off. And once people realized what it was, they came back to that. That was on Block Street. They came back to that part of the square.
The challenge with something like this, you can have 4,000 people and you can have 3,995 of them with the best of intentions and there for all the right reasons to bring attention to all the problems. It just takes a handful of people to do something
potentially
stupid.
Dangerous.
Yeah, potentially dangerous.
Right.
You mentioned there was an effort when this happened, people like, stop this.
Yes. There were a few times last night when maybe a bottle was thrown or fireworks went off, and a lot of the protesters, most, were trying to find out who it was and asking them to leave, and then trying to get other people to just leave the area. And you could tell a lot of the demonstrators who were there were frustrated by this. And I talked to one woman, her name's Destiny, she just asked to use her first name, but this is what she had to say.
I was born and raised in Fayetteville. I've lived here all my life. I'm black. I'm a female. We came out here to be productive. It's been a really good 4.5 hours. But stupid people want to mess it up, cause drama, and try to make it seem like we came out here to be bad or do bad things, and that's not what we're here for. We're here because we want to be treated like everybody else. We're here because we want our lives to matter as much as everybody else's. And right now, they don't. All this is doing is giving cops a legitimate reason to shoot at black people. And they fail to realize that. Them out here being stupid, who's the first person that's going to get targeted? Who are the first people that are going to get blamed? Black people. The ones who are yelling at them to stop. The ones that are begging them to stop are going to be the first ones blamed, and it's going to get turned into a negative protest, and it's just the opposite of that. We're out here because we want peace. We're out here because we want love. That's it. That's the only reason we're out here.
That was last night on the Fayetteville Square, and it should be pointed out, by all accounts, what I have seen on social media, talking to you and other people who observed it, it is being regarded as a peaceful successful gathering. One last thought I've had is, you know, the last time that I can remember the city of Fayetteville and its police department coming together like this was late in 2019 after the murder of a police officer on the square. The city lit up in blue. And I wonder, you'd hate, of course, you hate for that to happen, but the relationship between the citizens and the city's police seems to be one that works.
That's how it seemed last night. You know, every time that I spoke to one of the police officers or to demonstrators about working with the police, that was something that was stressed throughout the evening, is working together was important to make this a successful protest, to get the message across. And overall, it seems like it went well.
All right. Well, thank you for going. Get some rest. Wash your hands. And
oh, yeah. I'm covered in hand sanitizer.
Okay, very good. Daniel Crew, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
Welcome to 60 Second Civics, the daily podcast of the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. In 1848, a convention was held at Seneca Falls, New York, that launched a national movement by women to win the right to vote. Although suffrage for women had many supporters among men, the battle was a difficult one. In those days, it was common to believe that women should not participate in government. This idea made it harder for women to achieve their goal. Gaining the right to vote for women was a long, slow process. The earliest gains were made in the western part of the country. The Territory of Wyoming granted women the right to vote in 1869. But it was not until 1912 that the movement to give women the right to vote gained national recognition. Presidential candidate Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose Progressive Party supported the movement. In 1920, the states ratified the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which gave women the right to vote. 130 years after the signing of the Constitution, women had finally gained the right to vote. That's all for today's podcast, 60 Second Civics, where civic education only takes a minute.
The theme to 60 Second Civics, written and performed by Cheryl B. Englehart. You can find her online at cbemusic.com. The song featured there, Complacent, which you can find on Apple Music along with all of Cheryl's music. This is Ozarks at Large. Raven Cook, the founder and president of Foundations Black History Educational Programming, is back with us this Wednesday with a brand new edition of Reflections in Black that she wrote and recorded at her home.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. African American women educators played a critical role in the development of America in the 19th and 20th centuries. As a museum educator myself today, I find it beautiful to know that there has been such a rich foundation laid for me as one in the arts. One teacher's story starts in a very divine way. Born in 1851, Ella Shepherd was enslaved on the Hermitage Plantation in Hermitage, Tennessee. After discovering that a young Ella was being trained by the plantation's mistress to spy on her, Ella's mother, who was also enslaved, went to the river to drown she and her daughter to escape the bondage of slavery. When approaching the river, Ella's mother was stopped by an older enslaved woman who insisted no harm come to the child and prophesied that she had a divine purpose, saying, "The Lord have need of that child." The mother returned, and eventually 3-year-old Ella was bought by her father for $350 and sent to Nashville, Tennessee. Ella's mother would stay in bondage and be sent to Mississippi. After Ella's father faced financial troubles, she and her father would move to Cincinnati, Ohio. While living in Cincinnati, a young Ella Shepherd would begin her musical training, working with distinguished music teachers to learn piano and voice. Though recognizing the talent of this young woman, racism still remained, as the teacher would ask Ella to walk in through the back door and only come at night. The years became more difficult when Ella's father passed away in 1866. In an effort to provide for she and her stepmother, Ella began performing to audiences around the community, before finally deciding to move back to Tennessee to assist in the education of freed people. Recognizing her inexperience to be a teacher, Ella enrolled at Fisk University in 1868. The budding school was transformed from used Union Army barracks, and in an effort to keep the school afloat, a white instructor who had served in the Union Army and was acting treasurer, named George White, formed a group of singers. Ella Shepherd was asked to be assistant instructor, which would make her the first African-American instructor at Fisk University. Eventually, Shepherd would leave her post as instructor and go on to tour with the Fisk Jubilee Singers. The Fisk Jubilee Singers would travel around the world singing classics, but also the old spirituals that were sacred to those who had been enslaved. Their name came from the biblical Leviticus 25, which discussed financial and spiritual restoration. The group would travel throughout the United States singing for presidents, congressmen, and even travel to Britain to sing for Queen Victoria, who would commission a painting of the singers. Although the group was celebrated throughout the world for the beauty of their sound, they faced numerous obstacles. Racism, financial burdens, and fatigue would eventually wear on most of the singers, including Ella Shepherd, who would eventually retire as one of Fisk Jubilee Singers. Mrs. Ella Shepherd would marry and move to Washington, D.C., and become a close friend of men like Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington. Eventually, Ella Shepherd would move back with her family to Nashville, including her mother, who was told to spare her life all those years ago. Mrs. Shepherd also spent her life as an advocate for Black Americans, women's rights, and was an active member in the temperance movement. Sadly, she passed away at the age of 63 in the summer of 1914. But today, we remember the life and legacy of the incredible educator, Mrs. Ella Shepherd.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can find past editions at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
This is Ozarks at Large. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is awarding Arkansas over $8 million in coronavirus relief to assist low-income families with home energy bill costs. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with Arkansas Department of Energy and Environment Secretary Becky Keough about ways Arkansans can access the financial aid, as well as how ADEE is operating during the pandemic.
The $8.2 million was appropriated through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. Nationwide, qualified homeowners struggling to pay home energy costs will receive over $900 million in supplemental low-income home energy assistance program funding. Becky Keough is Secretary of the Arkansas Department of Energy and Environment, ADEE for short.
We're thrilled to have been notified that we will receive some supplemental funding, as you mentioned, of $8.2 and slightly more than that, I guess $8,209,119. Was allocated to Arkansas to supplement existing federal funds that will support our initiatives for what we call our low-income home energy assistance program, which is typically called LIHEAP. We are working up a program on disbursement of that funding through our existing programs with some modification, and that plan is expected to be fully developed and approved soon.
In Arkansas, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, federally funded through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Community Services, provides financial assistance to around 60,000 households every year to offset costs of heating, cooling, and cooking.
However, we've taken some initiative at a state level with federal funding to specifically make sure those funds that are typically distributed through what we call our winter and summer programs, are helping and supporting those that are directly impacted by COVID as well as those that had needs prior to COVID.
Keough says the Home Energy Assistance Program in Arkansas was administered by the Arkansas Department of Human Services, but is now run by the Arkansas Energy Office under ADEE.
We have quickly deployed the programs, transferred those programs, and it's, we're continuing to do that. I think we've received, we're roughly, we allocate a certain amount, just slightly shy of $10 million during the winter months and a little bit more, maybe $16 million during the summer months for those in need. But this additional $8 million you mentioned will supplement that.
Typically, Keough says, the Winter Heating Bill Assistance Program closes in May, which has been extended due to the pandemic.
We've also, so we've extended that into May with these changes. We've removed, of course, a shutoff notice submission since many utilities are working with in families and not exercising a shutoff notice anymore. So we're allowing them to just submit their notifications that they have bills due. And we're verifying that with the utility. And the benefit amount has been raised now per family from $500 to $1,000 to help offset those either current bills or bills that might have accrued while incurring this unemployment or perhaps their low-income status. We've also increased that they can apply a second time. So those that applied perhaps in January or February, for instance, can now come back during the month of May and into June and make that application.
Applicants must first prove residency, Keough says.
The income must be what they call 60% of state median income, which for one person, if you're below $20,352, you qualify. For two or three, it goes up based on the number of people in the household. So that would increase for a household of average of four, your income must be below $39,132. And if you're a family of six, of course, your income must be below $51,660. So it's a sliding scale based on the size of the household it's serving.
Arkansans seeking assistance can find information on the Arkansas Department of Energy and Environment website or call the LIHEAP program manager listed at 501-682-0977.
This is a locally administered program. So there are 14 agencies that are community action agencies established specifically for giving funding assistance to low-income individuals across our state. So they serve all 75 counties. So those that are familiar with working with their community action agency, that's who they would go to or contact.
Now, if it doesn't sound familiar, the Arkansas Department of Energy and Environment was created last year under the Arkansas Transformation and Efficiencies Act of 2019. ADEE absorbed the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, now a division, which Keough formerly led. Like all state agencies, the Arkansas Department of Energy and Environment has been impacted by the pandemic, she says.
We've been working hard. We have about over 95% of our staff remote working. They are delivering the programs efficiently, and in some cases, we were tracking that with metrics that, you know, we've been able to deliver the necessary permits. We're tracking inspections. We're working with local communities where they have needs. When we have an emergency, such as the tornadoes, we were responding to those. We responded to some events over the holiday weekend where there was an oil spill. So we've had a number of things that challenge us to be creative and innovative and protect the public, but we are out there doing the work we need to do. But there are challenges. We will be evaluating those things that we've been unable to do that we feel like either created too great a risk to our employee or to the public. And those things that we'll be looking at, and those are generally not emergency things, but those things that we do routinely, we'll go back and look at other strategies. In fact, we're having national conversations about how to do that for the long term. So we're hoping that everyone feels that they have access to us, and we continue to have an app where people can submit complaints and so that we can follow up if people do have a local issue that we might not be aware of otherwise.
Also in response to the pandemic, the Arkansas Pollution Control and Ecology Commission, which now operates under ADEE, is meeting remotely. Meetings are broadcast on Arkansas PBS, as well as the ADEE YouTube channel. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
NPR has announced the finalists and honorable mentions of its Student Podcast Challenge. Students from across the country in grades 5 through 12 invited to have their teachers submit the podcast they created. And three students in our area were named finalists or received an honorable mention. We'll be airing their podcast on Ozarks at Large this week. We begin with the honorable mention awarded to Cooper Zielowski, who attends Thaden School in Bentonville. He tells us about an out-of-the-ordinary 16th birthday party he attended where he and his friends faced off against grown men who had served in the military.
We were being transported to the station. We were a little nervous, but ready to win. Even though this was our first battle, we were ready. As our transport neared our station, we looked back and saw the enemy soldiers. They were wearing full uniforms with body armor. They held sniper rifles taller than Javier and had boots up to their knees. Meanwhile, we were wearing hoodies, sweatpants, and sneakers with standard-issue rifles. We were outmatched, but this was no war. This was Javi's 14th birthday party at the Modern Mission Airsoft Battlefield. I was expecting a fun airsoft birthday party and casual experience to introduce myself to the game. I was there with a few friends who had little experience. Most of them had done it before, but none of us were very good. We were all excited as we went through the training exercise. None of us saw it coming. On the way to the arena, we looked back and saw three men in full military uniform. At your traditional birthday party, you typically see the birthday boy and his friends having a good time together. Not really the birthday boy, his friends, and four grown men who compete in airsoft tournaments once a month who also happen to be in the military. They seemed nice enough to let us play by ourselves, though. Surely they'd leave us alone, right? Nah. It didn't make it any better that they started bragging about their stupid expensive gear. Yeah, this here rifle was purchased from Worldo Airsoft for about $800. Nothing too fancy. Our instructors told us that if you get within 10 feet of someone, you can just shout out surrender because they didn't want us to shoot each other at very close range. But these guys had special pistols that you were allowed to shoot each other with at close range. They were about as powerful as most of the assault rifles we were using, and they hurt bad. I asked them where they got their armor from, and they said it was real battle armor used in the army. One had a patch on their chest that said Certified Terrorist Hunter. All of this information did not make me feel good about this. I let the fear get to me, and I sat out for the first round. I was shaking a little bit, and I was all tensed up. Despite the warm spring weather, my teeth were chattering. It was not a promising start to the party. Sure, it was embarrassing, but I didn't want to get lit up by real-life soldiers in front of my friends. And they took it really seriously to the point that it was a little bit concerning. We were scrambling around and trying to escape. Meanwhile, they were in military formation, shouting out code names like, Alpha Beta 2! Alpha Beta 2! Scramble! In the first round, we lost 20 eliminations to none. Now it was my turn to play. And the screams of terror by my friends did not make me want to play anymore. If I'm being completely honest, I think they're a little bit insane. Because they went off on us. They showed absolutely no mercy. We were playing a game called Protect the President. Javi was the president, and he got to choose two bodyguards to defend him from the attackers. He did what any sane person would do and chose two of the grown men. I was an attacker. We got to send in a scout to locate the president, but he only had 1 minute to find them and come back to us. Our scout did not come back, so we were pretty much screwed. When we entered the arena, I was frightened and kept my distance from everyone, knowing that Javier's bodyguards would blow me up. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention. The men brought grenades to the party. Yes, grenades. I wasn't sure what was going on as I watched my team rush the president, but the next thing I knew, everyone was walking out of a metal storage crate, laughing and talking, except for Javi. Javi was bleeding. He had been shot at point-blank range by one of their pistols. The poor guy. To make up for what they'd done to us, we kind of messed with them a little bit, asking them sarcastic questions like, if I run out of ammo, can I use a knife? At one point, Rhett and Tobias took some of their ammo just to mess with them. Sure, it wasn't nice, but they'd crashed our party. Over the next few rounds, I started feeling a little more comfortable, playing a little more aggressively, and even got a few eliminations. I will say, it was pretty fun. I think what I learned from this experience is that, one, adult strangers do not belong at teenagers' birthday parties. And two, sometimes you've got to just try new things and step out of your comfort zone. I'm thankful to have been a part of this experience, and now I've got a great story to tell.
A podcast created by Cooper Zielowski of Thaden School in Bentonville. He was awarded an honorable mention in the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. Several students at Thaden School participated in a week-long intensive called Radio Thaden, where they wrote and recorded their podcast for the contest. We'll hear podcasts from students who were finalists in the challenge on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large and the Friday edition of Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. When caring for a seriously ill loved one, the journey shouldn't be taken alone. Circle of Life Hospice can help. Services are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. No one is turned away based on an inability to pay. 750-6632 or nwacircleoflife.com for more.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Moffitt, Oklahoma. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, Jacqueline Froelich, and Zuzana Sitek. Zuzana is our liaison for the student podcast that we are airing this week. Our show was mastered by Timothy Dennis. Stay tuned. The National Conversation from All Things Considered and NPR is next. A live hour of the latest, most accurate news regarding the virus, plus answers to your questions. The National Conversation beginning in just a moment on 91.3 KUAF. Tomorrow at noon, a brand new Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large, but I do want to alert you to something that's just a bit different about our shows tomorrow and Friday. They will be brand new shows, but we will be working with earlier than usual production deadlines, meaning on tomorrow and Friday shows, we will not have updates from Governor Asa Hutchinson's press briefing. You will still be able to follow those briefings if you go to the COVID-19 update page at KUAF and tune in to Antoinette Grajeda's newscast at 5:30 and 7:30 during morning edition. We will return to our normal production schedules and the governor's updates on our Monday edition of Ozarks at Large. Don't forget, you can find Ozarks at Large online at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also subscribe to our absolutely free podcast through any of the major podcast delivery systems. For this Wednesday evening edition of Ozarks at Large in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great rest of your Wednesday.